And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest is Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum. She's a research physical scientist in the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dahlia has a number of responsibilities in the study of landslides, including developing new techniques for rainfall-triggered landslide hazard assessment and forecasting. She is also the Associate Deputy Project Scientist for applications for the GPM mission. Now, GPM stands for Global Precipitation Measurement. The GPM mission is a constellation of sophisticated satellites that together make measurements of rain and snow of the entire world every 3 hours, including the GPM Core Observatory that can CT scan a hurricane. Dahlia Kirschbaum, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here again.
Boy, it's great to have you back. You know, our first conversation with you was back in 2014 when the GPM Core Observatory was first launched. And for those listeners not familiar with the GPM Observatory, can you give us a brief overview?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, or GPM, is following on from a satellite that NASA and the Japanese launched in 1997 called TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission. So GPM continues that legacy, working together with NASA and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA, and to launch the most sophisticated satellite to look at precipitation from space, rain and snow. And so, as you mentioned, it has two instruments on board that can both take kind of a CAT scan, a three-dimensional view of our atmosphere to look at rain and snow. And it also kind of looks at in an X-ray view, being able to tell the difference between light rain, heavy rain, and snow. These are the most advanced instruments to measure these types of precipitation features from space.
And what's the takeaway on what we have learned since the observatory went up and the constellation was sort of brought together where they collaborate together and share information?
Sure. Well, since we last talked last year, we've had some exciting things happen. And one of which is that because we're able to work not just with one satellite, but a constellation, as you mentioned, of satellites from both domestic and international partners, we're able to create a global view of precipitation unlike any other. And what's recently happened just this fall is we launched a near 20-year record of sub-daily, so like every 3 hour precipitation estimates, actually 30 minutes, for two decades to really understand how precipitation is changing rain and snow around the world at a daily time scale all the way to weekly, seasonal, and even at a decade scale. And so we're learning a lot about the energy cycles and water in our atmosphere and how that's impacting us here on Earth.
Dahlia, it's interesting. In the last couple of days, it seems like I've seen these headlines pop up about how modeling, precipitation modeling, is now enabling us to see weather further out. Now, we've heard from our local hydrologists that you can really never predict anything more than about 7 to 10 days out. But the headlines I've seen have talked about 28 days out. Is this a real thing, first of all? And does it have something to do with that collaboration and the communication between satellites?
Yes, that's a great question. And so there's different scales of weather forecasting. And so when you're talking about 28 days out, you're actually talking about sub-seasonal forecasting. That's like the 30 to 60 days. And so while it's not going to look the same as our weather forecast within, you know, a five-day forecast, which has been, you know, increasing tremendously in terms of its accuracy because of satellites, what it will allow you to say is it going to be above normal? Do we anticipate being below normal in terms of temperature or rainfall? And so it's a little bit of a different forecast, but with these sub-seasonal and seasonal forecasts, it can really give us that three-month outlook, which is really important for agricultural communities and other groups that may rely on whether or not we're going to have anomalies or differences from normal in precipitation. And so groups at NASA as well as at NOAA, National Weather Service, are doing this to better understand not just what's happening in the next, you know, 5 to 7 days, but really out to a couple months.
It's interesting. It makes me wonder how much that historical data plays into the modeling. You know, is there a percentage that you look at? And is weather changing so much that that's something that we sort of, well, of course, we don't disregard historical modeling, but, you know, what's the balance there?
Sure. I mean, so So having a reliable historical database of rainfall is really, really important for actually forecasting into the future. And the reason why that's important is because we need to understand how rain and snow particles in space, you know, in our atmosphere behave to be able to model those processes using actual data. And when you have a long record of information down to the individual particle scale, such as what we're getting with GPM and other estimates of precipitation, that helps us to create a more reliable estimate of the conditions that the model will use to estimate into the future. And so by having a long record of observations, both from the ground and from satellites, it only helps us to improve that future outlook through a better understanding of model physics and getting the initial date of the environment correct to forecast out.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum, research physical scientist at the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland. I also want to mention to everyone, when we post the podcast of this conversation to kpcw.org and other popular podcast sites, we will include with it four additional links that Dalia has provided from NASA on hurricane forecasting, on daily patterns of rainfall in the United States, and some new applications of global precipitation measurement data for microinsurance and agriculture and water resources. So we'll put all those on the podcast. Dalia, I wanted to ask you a question about satellites. The satellite era really began for us in the 1950s, and there have been many advances in the capabilities of satellites and their instrumentation packages and the analysis and the predictive capabilities. But one of the most important has been these sophisticated models that you were speaking about. Are we using AI to assist us with these models? What can you tell us about the advancement of the models?
Sure. Well, what I can say is, you know, as we're going forward, let's take hurricanes, for example, since that's a very clear example. We're right at the start of hurricane season, or I guess 1 month in for hurricane season. And so what we're finding is that with satellite information, our 5-day forecast for hurricanes is about as accurate as our 2-day forecast was 20 years ago. And so by being able to have this information and observations of storms from satellites, we're able to improve our ability and accuracy to forecast. And so in terms of artificial intelligence and things like machine learning, which is where you really require a large database of information to find patterns, right? So it's kind of pattern recognition. And so what satellites do is it gives you this database that allows you to understand the patterns and then match that with model physics, which is what the models do, right? They try to represent the states of our atmosphere. We need that vast body of data from satellites, as you said, starting in the 50s and moving forward to really get there. And so I think with satellites such as GPM, which allows us to better understand precipitation, but also understanding kind of the other components of the systems. What's the temperature on the surface? You know that in Utah, right, when in the morning it might be nice and balmy and then the surface heats up and you start getting thunderstorms in the afternoon because of all of that really strong convection and the heat exchange with the surface. And it matters if it's dry or if it's wet. So we can look at what's called evapotranspiration from the plants. We can look at temperature and humidity and relate that to precipitation and clouds and give us a much better picture of what's happening now to ultimately improve our forecasts going forward.
Oh, that's fascinating. And you mentioned last time we spoke to you, that in the latter part of 2020, there's going to be a couple of launches that will advance what we know about, you know, the wind blows from Africa, and next thing you know, we have a Category 5 hurricane hitting the East Coast. Have those launches occurred? And just give us an update on that.
Yeah, so we have over 24 satellites and instruments that are really looking at the state of our Earth. And so NASA Earth Science is really geared towards looking at Earth as a system of systems. Now, that might seem kind of like a buzzword, but what it really means is that we can use satellites such as Cygnus, which launched a couple years ago, actually, to look at the wind speeds off the surface of the ocean. We can use information from our European counterparts who have a series of satellites, and they've made all the data public, to look at both the thermal, so the temperature changes on the atmosphere and on the surface, as well as the different optical visions. How is vegetation changing? And then here we are working towards some new satellites that are going to be launched in a couple years to look at how the Earth's surface is changing, but also how our oceans are changing and how that bacteria and phytoplankton in the oceans may interact interact with sea surface temperature and salinity to really, you know, affect our global system.
It's just fascinating. Dahlia, I was wondering, earlier this spring, I was camping in an area where the night sky was, it was just so easy to see everything. There was very little light pollution. And I'm wondering, as we look up into the night sky in a situation like that, how many, you know, what percentage of the satellites that are out there are you able to pick up just with the naked eye? We saw so many, and it really, it's a great thing to do because it really orients you to what's going on in space a little bit and kind of gives that connection that we don't normally have.
You know, it's a great question. I don't know if I have percentage, but there's actually a site where you can track the International Space Station. So I don't know if many of you saw, just earlier this summer, we had the successful launch of two astronauts in a commercial vehicle from the first time in a long time, about 8 or 9 years, from U.S. soil. And they're currently sitting on the International Space Station. And so we can actually see that, the space station, from space. And so you can track it. If you just search track the International Space Station or spot the station, you'll be able to see where it is. And so, you know, it obviously comes over the United States, so you can start to track these. And some of the other satellites that that give us measurements about clouds. So there's some efforts by, for example, the Globe Observer, which is a citizen science and community science activity where you have different ways to interact and take measurements on the ground that then can be matched with observations from satellite to know whether or not the satellites are seeing the right thing. And so this is really important because while satellites are up there, you know, we have them in what's called a low Earth orbit, right? And those are the ones you probably can see with the naked eye if you're at the right place, the right time with low light pollution. And then you have ones that are higher up in space, and those you can't see. But being able to connect what the satellites are seeing to what we observe on the ground is crucial to improving, you know, our global data set. And so I can send some links over for you to post as well, but there are ways that your citizens and scientists, budding scientists, can get involved in taking measurements to help support and improve global estimates of what these satellites are taking.
That's a great thing. And it leads me into my next question, which is, it's so interesting that the work that you do, it's like half in space and half very oriented to what's going on the Earth. And it's so nice that you have that. It must be like it's not even separate, those two things, for you, because you're so oriented. But you have developed this citizen science system, the Landslide Reporter, which is this other part of what you do. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. You know, I think one of the great things about being at NASA is we work on satellites. We build things that are going to be launched into space. And, you know, many of those things look out into the galaxies. But as you mentioned, you know, many of those satellites are also pointed down at Earth. So we have quite a robust Earth science program. And so what I do in my research is I take data from these different satellites and combine them in models and even looking at the surface to understand landslides. And so, you know, we can use very high resolution, you know, optical, right, pictures of the Earth data to look at where landslides have occurred. We can also model the processes using satellite precipitation, rainfall data, land cover. So what does the vegetation look like? How steep is the topography? And that tells us a lot about what's happening. But as I mentioned before, all models need to be evaluated to know if they're doing a good job. And so with tools like Landslide Reporter, which you can go to at landslides.nasa.gov, we are able to engage the community to report landslides that they may have seen in the news or come across, so that we can get a better sense of where these events are distributed. You know, they often can be the size, you know, they're pretty small in general. And so seeing them from space routinely over the globe is impossible. So that's why we really need the community to help us improve this.
So Dahlia, as we improve our predictive capabilities for storms, basically, I guess if we know where and when it will rain, and that's certainly going to help you on the other side with all of the landslide work that you do. So that's why working these two areas is probably pretty important for you.
Absolutely. You know, being able to not only kind of give a sense of what is happening now or what has happened in the past, but what we're working on now is building a new capability to look into the future, to give a 24 or 48 hour forecast for potential activity for landslides. And that can be really important for emergency response groups and others to better understand and pre-position supplies for response.
Well, there's a lot that we know. There's a lot that you know about landslides, and there's probably some stuff that you probably don't know yet. What one question about landslides has not been answered that you would like to have answered? What's the most important thing about landslides that you'd like to know that you don't know?
Ah, that's a great question. And the answer is, I think in general, the community does not know how often landslides occur around the globe, right? We have different data sets from different places, but they're very sparse because it's such a local process. So if I had a magic wand and can wave it and say, this is the data set I want to know, even for just a time slice, you know, or a couple years, all of the landslides that occurred around the globe and when. That's never going to happen, at least not in the next couple of years. But that is something that can't necessarily be done from satellites entirely or even in part. And that's why we really try to approach this from both a satellite perspective and a human perspective to really get at understanding when these happen. I mean, we have tracking systems for hurricanes. We have a global seismic network for earthquake, but we don't have that kind of system for landslides.
Dahlia, I know because we talked to you soon after it happened, but going back to that landslide in Washington, the Oso landslide, mm-hmm. that there were some 40-some fatalities, and it went this huge distance across an entire river valley. And the predictability, I believe, was there in that landslide, but where was the disconnect? You knew it was going to happen. You had the modeling, although it was about 6 years ago, so I know it probably wasn't that advanced. But I'm just curious about an update on that landslide in particular, because it was so publicized, especially in the American West.
Sure. It was one of the most deadly landslides that we have had in recent times. I think there are multiple factors at play, and this is something that the U.S. Geological Survey has done extensive work on, so I don't want to speak out of turn since they are absolutely the authority. But what we observed, at least from our satellite record, it was one of the wetter seasons of the past about 15 years. Even though there wasn't rainfall immediately prior to the event, there was significant rainfall in the couple months leading up to that event. But then there were also elements of, there were observations on the ground of hearing cracking, et cetera. So there were preconditioning, information. But the idea of pinpointing exactly when a slope could fail is still extremely difficult, even today. And so what happened after the event is if you took information from an instrument called LIDAR, which sends like a pulse out to really look at a bare earth, you can actually see in that specific river valley, there were historic landslides very, very obviously identified on the landscape, both before and after. And so I think that for any disaster response or warning, it's very important to connect local warning systems, right? You can make the best warning in the world for any disaster, but if it doesn't connect to residents to know what to do or to get the word out effectively, it's not going to do much good, right? And so not that that would happen this time around in terms of predictability, but I think in general, if we kind of pull back to disaster awareness for landslides and other events, we need to connect the systems that both are alerting the public and provide information for them on what to do, and then provide information back to the emergency responders about here's what we think might happen for you to make an effective decision on how to warn the public. So it's this important connection between the scientists, the modelers, and the local practitioners and responders and emergency specialists to know how to behave. It isn't just one silver bullet to understand the entire process, and that is extremely important and something we're all working to continue to advance.
And so you started off with your response to my question saying it's the mm-hmm. USGS kind of purview, but I would imagine, how is that relationship between NASA and USGS in terms of sharing of information and, and then applying the models to mm-hmm. what they know?
That's right. Yeah. So I work very closely with the Landslide Hazard Program, which is actually located in Golden, Colorado. We have active collaborations on many topics. And, with respect to OSO, just to finish the answer I didn't quite get to, the state geological surveys are also very important in this process. They have a keen understanding and knowledge of the local terrain. And so with OSO, it's a combination of working with the state and federal agencies and local entities to better understand how to mitigate these types of events in the future. Going back to NASA, you know, NASA has a global reach. We work with people all over the world and in our country, of course. And so we work to enable and to provide information publicly that can be useful for operational agencies such as NOAA and the National Weather Service and others to make effective decisions. And so that's kind of the role that NASA plays in general.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum, a research physical scientist in the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dalia, I live on a mountain about halfway up. It faces into the south, so I get the prevailing winds pretty good. Since I moved there 6 years ago, yeah, I mean, it's always windy up there, a little bit of wind, but this is not born in science, but I need to ask you about this. Anecdotally, my observation is that it is windier more often, and it is blowing harder than it was 6 years ago, and I would say that these observations have been over the last couple of years where I think there's a demonstrable change in wind. Do you know anything about changes in wind with our new climate?
Right. Well, wind is not my area of expertise, but you know, with the southerly winds that are coming to those areas in Utah, I mean, they're coming and coming up basically from the south, right, from the Gulf and not the Gulf, but from the Pacific Ocean, and this warm kind of now end up being dry air comes up. You know, those types of strong wind patterns are primarily from differences in temperature. So when you have kind of hotter temperatures in one place, cooler temperatures in the other, right, the wind wants to go towards less pressure. And therefore, when you have these stronger differences, you end up having stronger winds related with respect to those. And so I don't know specifically in your area. I tried looking it up a little bit. I don't think I got the right got the answer I was looking for. But, you know, as we see in our changing climate, what impacts we might have. I mean, I did look up that, you know, we expect that, you know, Salt Lake City might get a lot warmer in the next 50 years as a result of climate change. Now, other areas may actually get colder. And then we know that those changes are not universal, right? Some areas will get wetter, some areas will get drier. And so going back to the beginning of our conversation talking about models, you know, what we're trying to do is actually take data from the past several decades and model processes back then, and then use that to model potential impacts in the future. So what is the range of temperature scenarios? So I'm working with somebody at NOAA, the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton, to test how we can take outputs from these models that project 50, 100 years into the future and understand impacts like landslides. And so we just published a paper earlier this year focusing on Nepal and high mountain Asia region, but we're really looking forward to expanding that analysis to couple future climate change with understanding kind of local impacts like landslides.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. And you talked about how wind likes low pressure. That kind of ties into hurricanes. When the warm air is rising and a low pressure is created, then something needs to fill that void, and that kind of starts the whole thing, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, you know, what we've learned about hurricanes and climate change and some of the recent work coming out is that, you know, while we don't know if there will be more frequent storms, and again, this isn't my area of expertise, but done a little bit of research in this, we are observing that storms are actually slowing down. They're getting bigger and they're slowing down because there's more water vapor that starts to fuel these storms, right? So Hurricane Harvey is kind of a case in point of that. Not that it's directly attributable to climate change, but 40 to 50 inches of rainfall falling on Houston as it just sat there over the ocean, the Gulf, and Texas, it's kind of a harbinger of what might come with these types of storms. As the slower they move, right, we're talking about winds, we're talking about ocean circulation and the atmosphere, the slower they move, the more opportunity for the high winds and storm surge and rainfall accumulations from flooding. And those are the most deadly parts of these storms. And so that, in terms of going forward with hurricanes, that is a huge concern that, you know, storms are slowing slowing down.
Dahlia, it's a bad question to ask you right at the end of our interview with only a few minutes left. But, you know, the rising sea and the California coast, landslides, you know, the coast being sort of eaten away. And I've heard stories, although I haven't witnessed with my own eyes, you know, what's going on and homes built so close to the edge of the coast there and what California is trying to come up with. What do you see happening there, you know, with these models that you have? What's the predictability of how many houses are going to fall into the ocean?
You know, our models intentionally are not that detailed, right? So we're looking at about a half mile or even larger area on the ground. And even that, you know, it's probably a little bit coarser than that. And so I think with that type of local impact, it really comes down to understanding and improving mitigation efforts to not have people build houses on cliffs that are going to fall, right? Because the wind and the water is going to kind of undercut the bottoms of these slopes and they fail. And that's just what happens. So really it comes down to arming the local building authorities, arming local populations with information about where they're at risk. And sometimes that information just isn't there. And so if we ended on a high note, I would say that, you know, while what I do is a lot in terms of disasters and there's a lot of uncertainty with the contributions from satellite and from the ground, I think that we are in an excellent position to provide additional information to improve our modeling, both at the very local hill scales with houses and identifying which houses might be the most vulnerable, all the way to kind of understanding global patterns of these disasters. And so I think there's a real opportunity going forward, and with machine learning, with data analysis and cloud computing, we just have so many more resources to do these types of big modeling efforts to better understand and predict for extreme events.
And I want to mention to our listeners before we let Dahlia go that she has provided 4 videos that we're going to post with our podcast, one on hurricane forecasting, one on daily patterns of rainfall in the United States, and a couple on GPM data. And Dahlia, we just love having you on the program. Thanks for joining
we
us
do.
This morning.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Please invite me back. I love talking to you guys.
Oh, we All will right. definitely invite you back. Thanks, Dahlia. Have a great day.
Bye now.
You as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.